relationships. And I would like to point out to you that over on the to my left is a suggested reading list. One book that I have up there is up on the bookshelf, up on the book table, called Escape from Loneliness, and this is Paul Tournier's book. When I first read this book, it helped me a great deal personally, and I have gone back to it many, many times. Paul Tournier is one of my favorite writers. I've read nearly everything he's written, and I think you'd find it very, very helpful. At your own leisure, you can copy down some of the others that are up there if you'd like to just pursue this this topic a little bit further. Where we're going today, the first session will be mostly definitive. We'll be covering the subject of what is the meaning of relationships. We'll be presenting a biblical basis for all meaningful relationships. We'll have some discussion on that. And then we'll have some general principles for building relationships, including a chart that I made from some passages in the book of Deuteronomy. Then tomorrow we'll have another session on some of the specific areas of relationship. So you don't need to copy this down particularly. We'll be following it in outline form. But this is where we're going. I think if you were to check in the Bible, you would find the very first relationship recorded is in Genesis 1:26. When in the process of creating the world, God said, "Let us make man." Now, I've heard that the Hebrew for us actually means the three of us, which would indicate, of course, the Trinity. And the first relationship, then, in Genesis 1, begins in a perfect fashion, and you'll never find a mistake in it in the entire Bible. Have you ever heard of a quarrel in the Trinity? You just don't. It is a perfect relationship. And I personally think that God wants us to have meaningful, significant relationships. Now, I don't think that on this earth he expects them all to be perfect, but I do think that he wants us to be meaningful and significantly related to people. And this means, actually, that experiences where two or more people show a significant association. It doesn't have to be highly intimate to be significant, but that we should have significant associations. This is being importantly united, not just plain united, but importantly united for a common purpose. Now, you've probably discovered that these relationships vary in degrees or levels of significance, but they still need to be significant. For example, we drove out from Ohio for this conference, and we found we had very highly significant relationships with the gas station attendants. They had what we needed. And one time, one of the gas station attendants said, "Have you ever heard of running on the fumes?" And I said, "Yes, I've heard of that. My tank is supposed to hold 22 gallons, and we put 22.3 gallons of gas in the car." Now, there was a highly significant gas station attendant. Now, we had nothing of an intimate association, of course, but it was highly significant. But now, when it comes to our family or someone else, we have a very significant relationship, but it's altogether different. When we relate to our women peers, we differ in our relationship than with men peers, but they're still significant. And we need to remember that not every relationship is going to be the same. You'll hear that for 3 hours, along with a few other things. Now, if we can realize these differences, it helps us to be realistic in our expectations. Probably one of the greatest difficulties in relating to people is the fact that we put unrealistic expectations on the relationship. They'll change, these relationships will, with geographic and proximity changes. In other words, we move and there's a change, but they still remain significant. They still have a lot of special meanings and importance to them. And by the way, I think you'll find, as I have found, that changes in relationships is one of the greatest costs in the discipling process. Not everybody feels the same, but people coming and going out of our lives cause us to have a sense of lack of continuity. And it's just something that is one of the costs and one of the prices. It isn't something to make us stop. It's just something to recognize. And God will make it up to us. I've often said when God picks one pocket, he puts something else back in the other one. And it's always better. And that doesn't mean that your next roommate's better than the one that just left. But in the change, in the process of change, God never just willy-nilly picks a pocket. He always puts something better back. Have you seen that cartoon that Norman Rockwell paints of the grandfather showing his pockets out to the little boy? Well, that's a reminder to me. One of my roommates decoupaged that on a stool for me to show that I have this little saying about God picking my pockets. And you find that when relationships come and go, that God always somehow makes it up to us. Now, our goal in this discussion, and by the way, we'll have some interaction and some discovery, is to help us to consider our relationship expectations and possibilities. I'd like us to be motivated to develop our relationships, and I'm sure we already are to an extent, that each of our relationships would be Christ-like, and they would be realistically set for where we are. By the way, this is as informal as we can make it. If I could sit down, I would. So that don't feel like I'm going to stand here and just talk straight at you. I'm going to move and talk straight at you. What do we mean, and what, first of all, Roman numeral 1, what is the basis for establishing meaningful relationships? Meaningful relationships to the infinite power is equal to GLA plus SA plus OP, where MRI is equal to meaningful relationships to the infinite power, God's love accepted, plus self-acceptance, and plus others preferred. Now let's go back and take each of them separately. First of all, God's love accepted. Who can quote Romans 5:8? Okay, Sue? All right. In the Berkeley, it says that God proves his own love for us. God commended his love toward us. Now, this is, again, one of those things that we need to take as a fact. God gave his love, and he proved his love when he sent his son to be the Savior. I think I'll cover this up so... This is a fact. It's a principle on which you can make decisions. When you feel unloved and alone, and you act toward other people like nobody loves you, all you need to do is remember Romans 5:8, and you will always know all the days of your life that somebody loves you. Simple. John 15:9, as the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. Now, what I'd like you to do is to take 2 or 3 minutes and meditate on that verse in any way that you want to. Just think about it. If you want to write some thoughts down, fine. But just think on that verse. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. And then we'll talk a little bit about it afterwards, okay? 2 or 3 minutes. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. Abide in my love. Dr. John Hanna from Dallas Theological Seminary spoke to us in Ohio last year, and he told us that the word abide is a combination of obedience and trust. In other words, trust and obey, and that's the way to abide. Another verse that helps us with this thought is 2 Thessalonians 3:5, and it says, "And may the Lord direct your hearts into the love of God and into the patient expectation of God." Now, what we find in these three verses is that God expects us to accept his love, but at the same time, he gives us the direction into this love. I just think it's so beautiful how the Lord gives us directions, and he doesn't give them to us to just do on our own. He always gives us a help. And here we find it again. May the Lord direct your hearts into the love of God. God takes our hearts and directs it toward his love. All right, the first thing then, the first basis for a meaningful relationship is accepting the love of God. And the second basis for accepting, having meaningful relationships is self-acceptance. When we're in conflict with others, it is always because we are in conflict with ourselves. Paul Tournier said that in his book, Escape from Loneliness. conflicts with others originate or are an expression of an internal conflict. We need to, first of all, begin, practice, and continue having a positive attitude toward yourself as you are. If you'll turn, well, you don't need to turn to it. Solomon, Song of Solomon 1:5 says, I am black, but comely. Now, what that verse tells me is that, okay, so I'm black, so I have some disadvantages, but I also have some advantages. My black is beautiful in its own way because it drives me to the Lord, and I needn't be all distressed over things that are wrong with me, even though at the same time, as I say that, I realize every time I find out something bad about myself, I'm surprised, and I don't know why I am, because I should be surprised that I don't find out more bad things. I am only a sinner, first, last, and always. And to find out these things shouldn't be such a surprise, but it usually is. Another thing that we can help ourselves with this business of self-acceptance is making difficulties become an opportunity. When I was in Thailand visiting my sister on a trip, we rode in a little thing called a tuk-tuk. And a tuk-tuk is a little three-wheeled vehicle run by what sounds like a John Deere tractor, only a smaller engine. It goes put, 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 and only the Thai word is tuk, 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 and that's what it sounds like, and so that's why they call it a tuk-tuk. Well, it's all open. It just has a canopy over the top of it. I was riding home in one day from visiting my sister, and I was looking out in this direction, and all of a sudden my breath was just totally taken away from me, and I couldn't imagine what had happened. I didn't know what had happened. And I looked at, I don't know why, but I looked, and here I was covered with muddy water. I was muddy water from the top of my head. My whole body was covered with muddy water. And I didn't know where it had come from, except it was raining outside, and so I, of course, figured out where it was. And a truck had gone by and had splattered, and the driver was all wet, I was all wet, and this driver was turning around, and of course now I'm an American tourist, obviously, and he's driving around and saying, using this word, Dai Lao, Dai Lao, Dai Lao, and I, did, of course, didn't know what he was saying. So when I saw my sister that night, I said, what does the word Dai Lao mean? And she said, it means, oh, for goodness sakes. He was driving down the road saying, oh, for goodness sakes. And I thought, how silly I must have looked with this dirty, muddy water rolling down my face. My glasses looked like a mud puddle, and I had to walk out of the... he expected me, I'm sure, to be upset. I wasn't really, but I had to walk out of this place across the lobby of the YWCA where I was standing, and of course everybody turned and looked at what a mess that woman was. I had on a white blouse, of course, and I really felt terrible. Well, but then I got to thinking about it as I was walking, and I giggled all the way from the tuk-tuk into the YWCA. I just thought, how a ridiculous sight this was, and what this man must have gone home and told his wife that night. He would have said, honey, this American tourist is sitting back there, and did she look a mess? And I could just had visions of this whole thing happening. Well, the thing was, it was a difficulty. I was a mess, and yet I had to go out in front of all these people, hard on your vanity, you know. And I thought, now the Lord can help me have a good attitude toward this, or I can be upset. And he did help me on the whole. I felt pretty embarrassed, but he did really help me to get in the why without too much catastrophe. And I don't know why that works, to help have you learn to accept yourself when you can do things like that and not feel guilty over things. And it builds in a good attitude toward yourself when you can take a difficulty and make it become an opportunity. Some of you may know the name of R.E. Thompson. They are founders of Missionary Internship. And when they were in their 50s, they were visiting the United States. They are missionaries from Great Britain to China. During the time they were visiting in the United States, China closed. It was taken over by the communists. And here were 50-year-old missionaries stranded without a country. Well, now, this is a pretty big thing. It's a pretty big difficulty. Mr. Thompson couldn't drive. There were numbers of things that he couldn't do because he'd spent all of his life in the back part of China, apart from 5 years they had spent in concentration camps. And they'd had their share of difficulties. Well, you know what they did? They turned it into an opportunity. They decided, well, they'd stay in America. They had a burden to teach missionaries how to get used to the field before, as much as they could, and prepare. And so they founded this organization of preparing American missionaries for service overseas. It's still going on. There have been many, many people greatly helped. And it is always stands to me as a monument to people who took a major difficulty, turned it into an opportunity. Their whole life ministry wiped out by one act of government, and they turned it into an opportunity. C is preferring others. This is a tremendous help in developing relationships. Philippians 2:1-4. And he says here, if therefore in relationship with Christ there is any encouragement, if there is any persuasive appeal of love, if there is any fellowship in the Spirit, if any affections and compassion, then make my joy complete by being in agreement, having the same love, being united in spirit, having the same attitude, doing nothing out of selfishness or conceit, but with humility regarding others superior to yourselves. Neither must each be looking all only for his own interests, but also for those of others. Now there is enough there to keep us busy for many, many days. If we would concentrate on these verses, thinking about how we can prefer others. In other words, where we take the other person's interests as more important than our own. And how this helps us in the idea of meaningful relationships. Now, why do we say that it takes all three of these to develop meaningful relationships to the infinite power? And do you all know what infinite power means? It means that you can multiply a number as many times as you could do, and you could always come to one more. It goes off into infinity. There is no limit to it. So we could have limitless meaningful relationships by the combination of these three factors. Now what I'd like you to do is, I like that word I heard yesterday for the first time, neighbor nudge. Would you just turn to your neighbor, or two or three of you, and discuss a bit how you can see the connection between these three concepts, accepting God's love, accepting ourselves, and preferring others, how these three combinations can come up with meaningful relationships to the infinite power. Just talk for two or three minutes that are basic. Certain basic principles that we need to follow for maintaining. Now we saw how to develop them. Now let's see how to maintain meaningful relationships. There's nothing profound about these, except that they're things that I've noticed over a period of time. When I violate these, then my relationships become rocky. First of all, A, being yourself makes other people more able to be themselves. Sincerity gives birth to sincerity. Being yourself makes other people more able to be themselves. Now, you know, people would rather relate to an ugly, sincere person than to a sweet, sincere, insincere person. Have you ever stopped to think about that? You know the person that's insincere and very sweet and says, oh, that's all right, when underneath they're mattering and talk. Isn't it easier to have somebody turn to you and say, boy, that did hurt my feelings, than it is to have somebody smile sweetly and say, oh, never mind, forget it. And the thing then that happens when we do that is that the people respond to us the same way. And what we've got then is the games people play. You know, the I'll be sweet and you'll be sweet and we'll all smile sweetly together. And it isn't like that. So being yourself makes other people more able to be themselves. Now the guideline on that is that we never have the freedom to be ourselves at somebody else's expense. We can't hurt other people in the process of us being us. All right. The second suggested principle is that communication channels must be kept open if we want to develop mutual honesty. We have to have open communication channels if we're going to develop mutual honesty. I have a younger sister who is married to a very wonderful man, and my sister, of course, is the best younger sister anybody could ever have. So this makes two very wonderful people. Well, they were married quite young, and they'd been married for about 6 months when they were downtown window shopping. That was, at that time, their best means of shopping, and they were shopping, looking around, and they saw this bird, a canary. in a cage. And Mary turned to Ren and she said, "My brother's name is Renard. It's Dutch, so it's Ren, not Bird Ren, but Arjen." She turned to him and she says, "Ren, wouldn't that be nice to have a bird? Isn't he a cute bird?" And Ren said, "Yes, that's a very nice bird." Well, they talked more, and it wasn't quite as stilted as I just said it, but they talked about it. The very next day, Ren came home with the bird. So for 6 months, they had this lovely singing canary in their house. Finally, one day, Mary turned to Ren, and she says, "Honey, do you like that bird?" And he says, "No, I hate the thing." For 6 months, they'd had the bird in the house, and neither one of them liked it. And they each thought the other one liked it, so they let it stay. Now, that sounds kind of funny. And when they were telling it, they were laughing because they thought it was funny. But what they learned from it is an important principle that is very characteristic in their marriage today, and that is they're open and honest with each other. And they learned it in this kind of a setting. Now, it seems maybe 6 months a long time, but I thought for a young couple that was pretty good. I've known people that have gone for 10 years with things they've been upset about and never said a word about it. So I was pretty proud of them for learning that lesson that young. So communication channels need to be kept open. All right, the third basic principle is that we will never have mature, meaningful, positive relationships if we are tolerating sin in our hearts and we're a Jesus person. We cannot have mature, meaningful relationships if we're tolerating sin in our hearts. It is the barrier to all meaningful relationships. It's a root of bitterness. Hebrews 12:15. You've probably memorized that. When bitterness springs up, many are defiled, and grace is inadequate. The grace isn't inadequate, but we have not appropriated it. These principles have become to me checkpoints. And when I have a sense of rockiness in my relationship, I can go back to these, and I do. Find out what it is that's wrong with me, and invariably, there'll be something in my heart. You know, maybe I didn't originate the rocky relationship, but I added to it by something that was sinful in my heart, and I have to confess it and straighten it out. All right, the fourth principle is that one that I've earlier mentioned. One may expect each set of relationships to be unique in themselves. Each set of relationships is unique. I have an illustration that I'm scared to use because I can't get the words out straight. But it just stands out. If you ride on a city bus, you have the bus driver takes your money or your tickets. When you're overseas, a lot of times, like in Thailand, they have ticket takers, bus ticket takers. Got it out. And this bus ticket taker is a very important person because he's the one that represents revenue to the bus company. And he makes very sure that he gets your money. Now, you contrast this person and, say, your brother or your sister or one of your parents. And again, you know, it's the same thing as the gas station attendant. That they are different, but they're both unique. And they both need to be meaningful. We have no reason whatever to be rude to people just because we think we'll never see them again. Now, I'm sure we are all do that sometimes, and we need to be careful that we treat them with the same respect that we would want to be treated. All right, the next principle is that praying for others creates positive relationships and it prevents mental arguments. Praying for others creates positive relationships and it prevents mental arguments. We have a thing at our house about eating on time. It happens to be something that I have to do to maintain good balance, and it is also something that helps us with just keeping on schedule. Well, I learned a lesson about that one day when I came home and one of my roommates was late with supper. It was a Saturday night and nothing was done. It was nearly 6 o'clock. There was no supper, and I walked in the kitchen and in my nice little sweet way I said, "Who is supposed to get supper tonight?" And in her nice little sweet way she says, "I don't know." And in my nice little sweet way, I said, "Why don't you know?" Well, of course, by that time I was convinced that I was wrong, and I apologized and I said, "I'm sorry, let's start over again." And so I started back and saying, "Does anybody know who's supposed to be cooking tonight?" And I learned from that, you know, that when I came barging in, upset because something hadn't been done correctly, and came on in that tone of voice, all I did was create chaos. Nobody could think even who was supposed to be cooking. And all it did was delay us another 10 or 15 minutes. And I had a guilty conscience for a few minutes. It all worked out okay, and I think we went out. I'm pretty sure that's what we did. That was a year or so ago, but I think we went out. But I realized if I had walked into that kitchen and realized nothing was being done, and if I had said, Lord, help me know how to be part of this solution, I would have gotten a lot farther, and we might have even been able to eat at home. Maybe I should do it this way and eat out again sometime. But if we pray for people, it creates a positive thing. When people hurt us, if we would just stop and pray for them a minute and ask the Lord to forgive them, and then get on with being some part of the solution, it would really help. And the last general principle is that we answer to God for the way we relate to people. We are responsible for our own relationships. We can never say to anybody with honesty, you make me so angry. The reason we can't say that is because we chose to become angry with what they did. The correct response there is, when you say things in that tone of voice, I am sorely tempted to become raging angry. Now, it's possible to say it like that. But what the point is that we can't say to anybody, you make me do something. You can say, you tempt me to anger. Or however you would say it. I don't know. I probably would say, when you say things in a tone of voice like that, I sure am tempted to do something very drastic. That would be what I might say. Like for me, being drastic would be walk away from the situation and leave her standing. Or something like that. But we are responsible. If we respond in a wrong way, we're responsible. If we create a temptation for somebody else. Matthew 18:5 and the Philip says, in the nature of things there will be pitfalls, but woe to him who is responsible for them. And it's very true. Woe to us if we're responsible for the pitfalls. All right, let's quickly run through those again. Being yourself makes other people more able to be themselves. Sincerity gives birth to sincerity. What's the second one? Open communications. What's the third one? You can't tolerate sin. What's the fourth one? Each relationship is different. And the next one? Praying for others creates positive relationships. And what's the last one? We answer to God. Are there any questions on these principles? Connie? The question is, how can you help a person be sincere when you get the feeling that they're being super sweet insincerely? Okay, that's part of the illustration I used earlier. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. P.S. number one. It's part of the culture. Well, I'm not sure I can answer that because I'm not from the South. I'm really from the North, and but I do know that sincerity creates sincerity. And if you respond to people sincerely and sometimes give them a reading of how they're coming across, that will help. You know, somebody comes in and gushes at you, isn't this the most tremendous thing we've ever seen? Now, I had a roommate like that one time, and she came in at 6 o'clock, and she said that to me, and I turned around and I said, no, this isn't really the most tremendous thing I've ever seen. It's nice, but it isn't the most tremendous. And I laughed. It didn't upset me particularly. I just thought it was kind of funny. Now, I don't know whether you could do that in the South Helene. Yes, I would agree with that. The thing is knowing how you would answer it so they wouldn't be offended by it. I think that's culturally, you just need to get your answer correct. Teach the principles, right. I think sincerity, the reason that we make a point of sincerity is because if you're not sincere, you're being dishonest. And the Bible talks about a man of integrity has many promises, but there's not a word of promise for a person who isn't honest. I don't see any hope for a dishonest person. But I do see, unless they change, but there's tremendous hope for the honest. And so probably which in the case I did with this girl, as I sat her down after that, we had a good laugh about it. And she was always using superlatives. And so we just talked one day about it, and I just shared with her the principle of being honest and that we need to save superlatives for superlative situations. And not use them on that day by day. Barb? Helping them to eliminate pat answers, in other words, from their vocabulary. Okay? Does that help you, Connie? Mm-hmm. All right. I have a worksheet that covers some more principles that I'd like to have passed out now. It's on several chapters from the book of Deuteronomy. I did this study for myself and was greatly helped by it. And I trust that as we go through it, we'll make it really informal and yet try to put some structure to it. First observation from Deuteronomy 4:21-24 is that Moses reminded them to love only God, for he is jealous. The fact of God being a jealous God means that he wants only one devotion for us, primarily, and it's out of this devotion then that all the rest of our devotion arises, and he's jealous when anything gets between him and us. And the principle that I drew from that is that people should love God first and foremost. Now, what verse do you know that tells you the same thing, that God is the object of your first affection? Matthew 6:33. Okay, you may write that in. And the situational application is that when we're tempted to act as a non-Christian, for instance, selfishly, there are many times when we're tempted to ask selfishly. If we would stop at that time, and instead of demanding, for instance, when we're helping our younger Christians, this is really an important thing, to help our young Christians learn how to not be selfish. If we could learn some things early in our Christian life, it would save us a lot later. And even though selfishness seems like an age-long problem, still there are things we could help our people with early. When we are tempted to be selfish, if we would stop and think, seek first God's kingdom. What does God want me to do in this way? Should I be trying to get attention for myself, or is there somebody else that I should get attention for? And if we would stop and go through some of these mental processes, it would really help us to not act quite so selfishly. The second one is the Ten Commandments, if kept, would enhance all sorts of relationships. Does anybody question that? No, I don't think so. The principle is that relationships are best when based on God's standards. I'll leave that one for you to find a cross-reference on later. And the situational application is, when in conflict with a co-worker, review Philippians 2, 3, and 4. And we've already read that, that we should not prefer ourselves, but other people. And the conflicts with our co-workers are often because our own interests are stronger than our interests for our co-workers. I have X amount of work to get done. Somebody asked me to do something else, and I begrudge it. This always happens in the spring, you know, when we have things like summer training programs to think about, when we have the end of the year to conclude, and many, many other things, and somebody sends us a study they want us to fill out, or when somebody asks us to do something else. And we always have our own work that is there. And let me tell you something, it will always be there. You'll never be done, because we're women. And you know, the proverb says a woman's work is never done. So, don't you like my reasoning? That when we have conflicts, we just need to go back and review it, because the principle stands that relationships are best when based on God's standards. And one of God's standards is to prefer others above ourselves. Now, that doesn't mean we should ever be negligent in our responsibilities, but it does mean that we should prefer others first. The third observation is the enemy was to be destroyed so its influence wouldn't permeate Israel. And I don't know if you've ever had questions in the Old Testament about how God destroyed the enemy. I know I had. I had a great deal of enemies until, questions. I had a great deal of questions about that until one time my area rep helped me with it by using the verse to show me that I needed to cleanse a certain temple that needed cleansing, and that if I didn't destroy the enemy, that we would only have it multiplied. And I had to go to this person and help her with cleaning her temple before God. And this is it's an observation throughout the Old Testament that the enemy was to be destroyed so its influence wouldn't permeate Israel. Now, the principle is that the source of evil influence must be destroyed. And I gave just a situational application that if I can't change the people, I need to remove myself from a gossiping group. It breaks the power of the momentum of a gossip group if you just get up and walk out. Do you know another cross-reference that tells you that the source of evil must be destroyed? Well, we should find one on that. We'll go on at this point, and maybe we can come back to that. All right, 1 Corinthians 5, 6. All right, the next observation from Deuteronomy 7, 17 to 22 is that the antidote for fear is to remember what God has done. The principle is God's power is greater than any fear. And the situational application is to call on God's power to overcome fear of authority. This is something that many of us go through. We've gone through it at various stages, and periodically we go through it again. When we are afraid of somebody who is in authority, we need to call on God's power to help us relate to that person in a courageous way, which is just being ourselves. We have a saying in our area, one of the men that I work with says, when all else fails, be yourself. And it is, in fact, one of the very best things that God could give us the courage to just be ourselves. And when we are this way, under the power of God, then we can relate to our authority in the right way. And I have seen many, many, many girls who have difficulty with authority. And we're going to talk about that in more detail tomorrow. But it's not knowing how to relate to authority, either positively or negatively. They come at it with the wrong way, and it is something that we need to work on. Another observation from the same passage, Deuteronomy 7, 17 to 22, is that the Lord destroyed the enemies at the right speed. You'll notice throughout the entire Old Testament that God didn't take one false swoop and destroy all of the Babylonians or all of the Chaldeans or all of the Persians or all of the kings that were out to get them. He destroyed them at his right speed. And the principle that we can draw from that is that the processes of God are best. Then a situational application where we might use that is to thank God for the process of winning a girl's heart in order to disciple her. You know, you've probably all had this experience where it takes you long to win a girl's heart sometimes. Sometimes, you know, you kind of click right away. Other times there's a long process involved. And don't you sometimes get impatient with that? You want her to be recruited right now. And it won't work like that most of the time. Well, when we're frustrated or a little bit discouraged over the process, we can think of that principle that the processes of God are the best. There's something that's better in this process than to just have it right now. And we can thank God for that. What do you know about the fact that the processes of God are the best? Have you had any experience, or do you know a verse that tells you about that? Maybe one person, we can have one person share. Oh my. All right. All right, what's the reference? 2 Samuel 22:31. This way his God is perfect. The last observation on this page is from Deuteronomy 9, verses 4 to 6. The people were to realize it was the wickedness of the Anakim, not the righteousness of Israel, that brought destruction to them. This was obviously an important observation, because if the Israelites thought it was their own righteousness, look what they would have created. They would have a very good case of self-righteousness. And the principle we can draw from that is that self-righteousness is not approved by God. Situational application. Evaluate a current conflict. Am I feeling self-righteous over anything? Supposing we have a conflict. And by the way, conflicts are not necessarily all bad. Conflicts many times can help us to understand ourselves and understand other people. They're not something to be ashamed of. They're not something to avoid. You know, peace at any price is not necessarily the best way to go. That a conflict can really be used, but if we're having one that is not being resolved, we might ask ourselves the question, am I feeling self-righteous? In other words, is the other person wrong and I'm right? If this is the way we're feeling, chances are we need to evaluate and say, all right, I may not be right and I may not be entirely wrong, but is there anything I need to do to correct? And there's nothing wrong with saying that. There's nothing inherently wrong with being wrong. We shouldn't always be right. If we think we have to always be right, we're on the wrong track. We're wrong already to think we already always have to be right. Because we're human. And it's God wanting to do something for us, to take the wrongs and make them right, that is the process of growing in sanctification. Self-righteousness is not approved by God. Does anybody know the verse in Romans that talks about self-righteousness? Right. You want to share it, Kathy? As God has allotted to each the measure of faith. All right. Self-righteousness is not approved by God. Deuteronomy 16, verses 9-12, talks about the Feast of Weeks. And it was a celebration of gratitude for freedom. They were to celebrate this certain feast. And a principle that I drew from that is that gratitude expressed will keep it in priority. In other words, if we set a festival once a year, that'll help us to remember it. Actually, that's where most of our holidays began. I heard a most interesting lecture not long ago, by a professor of religion at Ohio State University, and she pointed out how most of our holidays began as religious holidays, even Halloween. Even Groundhog's Day began as a religious festival, and it actually had to do with bears instead of groundhogs, but when they got to America, there weren't enough bears, so they went to groundhogs. Now, that has nothing to do with what we're talking about, but it's so important, I wanted you to know it. If we can express our gratitude, it will keep us in priority. The application can be when we're discouraged over conflicts or disruptions. If we can express something to be grateful for, it can really help us in our discouragement over conflicts or disruptions in relationships. Does anybody want to run for presidency of Feast of Weeks for next year? Deuteronomy 22, verse 12. The observation is that the tassels, means of showing belongingness, were to be kept visible. Do you remember in Fiddler on the Roof? Right at the very beginning, they talked about the tassels and what they meant. Well, the principle is that God cares for our sense of belongingness. He really wants us to feel that we belong. And the application from that can be when responding to ideas from leadership that make us feel insecure or uprooted. All we need to do when we feel insecure or uprooted is to go back and remember, all right, in the Old Testament they had the tassels, in the New Testament I have God's Word. They were visible means to show belongingness, which, by the way, is what the Mennonites and some of the other more conservative groups do. They have these various means, and the reason they do it is to show that they belong. You know, the little caps. We were up in Amish country. Ohio has several communities of Amish people, and we were up and had lunch the other day at the Berlin House, and we saw the Mennonite people with their little hats, and they want to announce to the world that they belong. Now, we would perhaps choose a different way, but sometimes I wonder if it wouldn't be good to hang our verse packs around our neck or do some other thing that shows us that we belong. But God has chosen to record it for us, and we're told in Scriptures that we belong. And these tassels were the visible means. The next observation comes from Deuteronomy 24, verses 10 to 13. A poor man's pledge is to be treated with dignity. The principle that I drew from that is that poverty is no excuse for treating a person with disrespect. This winter when we were snowbound in Columbus, I resorted to riding the buses. I don't usually, because I always think I'm too much in a hurry and the buses take too long. But this one time my car was snowed in and I couldn't get it out, so I was on the bus. I was downtown along with, I thought, about half of the rest of Columbus. There was a man standing there who was obviously very poor. He was mentally retarded, I assumed, from the way he acted, and he was very dirty. And I looked at him and I thought to myself, I wonder who he belongs to, and I wonder who his mother was. And I was just daydreaming, thinking about where did he have to go home. He was talking. He talked the whole while we stood there, and I had to wait for 20 minutes. And all the while he was talking, if somebody was standing in front, they listened. If they weren't, he kept talking anyway. He just kept talking the whole continual time. And I was repulsed at first. I wanted to turn away from him. He looked so physically bad. But I realized after, when I was half turned from him, and I was smitten in my heart that his poverty, both physically and mentally and socially, had repulsed me. I was stricken that was wrong for me to feel that way. So I turned around and faced him, and I asked the Lord to give me a love for him that would somehow change his life. And I have no idea how that kind of prayer can ever be answered when you're standing in front of a strange man that you don't necessarily want to be in very much conversation with. I doubt if he could have conversed with me anyway. But just that poverty was no excuse for me to treat him with disrespect. And I asked the Lord to forgive me and to help me to love that person so that his life could be changed. Another situation could be watching ourselves for social discrimination in selecting girls for follow-up. I know of one campus at one time where they were not allowed to follow up any girl if she was fat. And the word fat came across in the team leader discussion about evangelism. And so then there was this big discussion. Now, this was a co-ed discussion. The discussion came up, what do you call fat? And it got to be a very difficult thing. It was difficult because it obviously came across to the girls as social discrimination. And they had to go back and talk and discuss. And out, by the way, the happy story that is out of that campus since then has come many, many healthy converts. And that policy has long since been changed. I understand the heartbeat of it. The heartbeat was they wanted to get to the girls who would respond. And so they thought that the person making the decisions thought that the people who would make the response the quickest would not be people that they thought would have social problems. Now you see how sticky this gets. And don't be too hard, and don't take this illustration wrongly, that they learned some good lessons, and this campus is now producing some very, very healthy people, spiritually and physically as well. But that we need to be careful that we don't socially discriminate in selecting girls for follow-up. That we don't say no to a girl just because she has some physical features about her that are difficult for us to accept. We need to be the ones to accept. We need to be the ones to make adjustments, to nurture and to care for Christians after they have been born into the kingdom. Now, selection and selecting people for leadership is another story. You have to select people for leadership who want to be leaders and who want to have the advanced training that we're prepared to give. But this is not what I'm mentioning here. The last observation comes from Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 and 15. Hired servants were not to be oppressed. The principle, ownership or authority is no excuse for oppression. The situational application is that perhaps some of you will have an opportunity to help a young summer training program team leader be merciful to an erring recruit. Now, that's a little stiff way of saying. Sometimes we get into training programs, and as soon as anybody does anything wrong, they're told about it. And I have a bit of a problem with that, because I think what that really communicates is that there is no mercy and that there's no room for learning what the rules and regulations are. Now, I think that we need to correct people. I believe that correction is right. I believe that rebuke is correct, that we have to help people. But I don't think that our authority is any excuse for oppression. And it comes across as oppressive when every little thing that everybody does that's wrong gets called to attention. And we need to be careful of that, because it doesn't give us a Christ-like relationship with the person. It puts the person off. It makes them afraid to volunteer. I've seen situations, and you probably have too, where people have been afraid to try anything for fear they do the thing wrong, and they didn't want to be corrected for everything they did wrong. It's the same principle as when we have a serving project and have people serving and then correct them all the way through their serving. I think if you're going to train a person in skills, call it skill training, and then when people serve, let them serve. It's like when you ask somebody to set the table and they set it and you don't tell them how you want it set, and then you go along behind them and correct everything they've done. It's very destructive to your self-image, and you're not going to have people volunteering to do things if you follow up everything they do and move a little knife a half inch down and push the napkin a quarter of an inch up and things like this. Now, I'm, of course, being extreme here. But we need to be careful that we don't use our authority for oppressive reasons. It doesn't help us in developing good relationships, and over the long run won't help us to accomplish everything that we want to accomplish. Now, do you have any questions so far on what we've done on this thought through on Deuteronomy? Connie? All right, let's review. First, we talked about a definition of relationship, and we said that it's significant, meaningful experiences, commonly united for a common purpose. Then we talked about the biblical basis for relationships being MR to the infinite power is equal to God's love accepted plus self-accepted and plus others preferred. Then we went through certain principles, and now last we've gone through these general principles from the book of Deuteronomy. Do you have any questions or comments?